History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and, more importantly, to listen intently and patiently as memories from long ago take on fresh meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, what we find is that not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we become truly inspired by what we hear from these members of our greatest generation. I had planned this weekend to introduce you to a Purple Heart recipient in Colorado, and in the weeks ahead, a couple of ex-prisoners of war. But I decided to dedicate today's episode to a World War II veteran whose story, whose life, whose passion may have inspired more people around the world than any other member of that greatest generation. That would be very hard to calculate, and it's certainly not a competition. They all inspire me in different ways, but Louis Zamperini has been on my mind the last couple weeks. Many of you know that name, and if not the name, you certainly know the book Unbroken by Laura Hillenbrand or the two major motion pictures that have followed. Louis was on my mind on Easter Sunday when I happened to be in Torrance, California, where the Olympian first became a track star. The Torrance Tornado, they called him. I drove down Zamperini Way and saw the Torrance Airport, itself now known as Louis Zamperini Field. From Torrance, I went to the University of Southern California to pick up our daughter, who's studying there, her dorm right across the street from the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum, where Louis once raced for the Trojans. Even in church that Easter Sunday, there were connections and reflections of this legendary Olympian turned prisoner of war. But the last nudge that convinced me I needed to revisit Louis' story this week was when photos started showing up on social media, marking the 80th anniversary of a mission that nearly ended his life. Maybe you saw one of those photos this week, Zamperini peering through a hole in the side of his B-24 that the enemy put there 80 years ago over the Pacific island of Nauru. So I finally decided I should take the hint and share Louis' story with you today. Some of you listening have heard some of it before, but most of you probably haven't. Ideally, I like to visit with the veterans you hear on Hometown Heroes in their homes, where they're most comfortable. But when I had the chance to interview Louis back in 2011 over the phone, I couldn't pass that up. And hearing him tell the story, 94 years old at the time, but as sharp as any 30-year-old, is something that never gets old for me. Let's start with how he earned that nickname that would follow him forever, Lucky Louis.
I just moved into Long Beach from Olean, New York, from the cold climate to the warm climate, and a kid challenged me to a race. And he beat me, and he ran across the street and was hit by a car and mangled. So that was my first loss. And I had another race a couple of years later in Torrance when we moved there, and this kid challenged me to a race across the street, and I lost that one, and he was hit by a car. So, you know, I was lucky I wasn't fast.
Yeah, I guess that's a situation where it's good not to be the fastest. But soon you would be the fastest. They started calling you Zamp the Champ around Southern California. You ended up at USC, and in 1936, you made the U.S. Olympic team.
Well, first of all, to make the Olympics, I'm running against the world record holder in the 5,000 meters and the 2 mile, mm-hmm. especially the 2 mile, and we came in a dead heat, so that was a big thrill. That put me on the team, and of course, during the Depression, we used to forage for food. We were so hungry, and there was unemployment was bad. And but I got aboard a ship, and I'm stunned. I can't believe the food they kept bringing to the table. I mean, they just kept bringing stuff. And so my gold medal was to see how much I could eat before I got to Berlin. I gained 14 pounds, and that was too much.
14 pounds on one little cruise across the Atlantic.
Yeah, and then when I got to Berlin, I thought, I'm going to work it off. But then they have this beautiful village. They had a semicircle, two-story building, and each door was a door to every nation's cuisine. Mm-hmm. So I had to try them all.
Well, of course.
Yeah, of course. So I couldn't keep up the pace in the 5,000 meters. So I'm way behind, 50 yards behind the leading pack. I'm in the second pack of guys. But in the last lap, I thought, oh, man, if But my brother always told me, he said, he was a coach, he said, everybody's tired, the third lap of the mile. But think of it this way, just open up and run your guts out, because isn't 1 minute of pain worth a lifetime of glory? So I sprinted the whole last lap, and of course it brought the grandstand up. I see a runner gaining 50 yards on the leader,
mm-hmm.
and I came down the home stretch with the first pack, but I only got eighth place. But then it was in the papers that I ran the last lap in a blistering 56 seconds, which is unheard of. And then as a result of that, I got Goebbels, I guess it was, came over from the officers. German officers were between Hitler and the American team.
Right.
And he said, Hitler wants to see you. I said, hey, I didn't win a gold. He said, well, he wants to see you. I went over and he just said, the boy with the fast finish, a light handshake, and that was it. I guess it was exciting to see someone gain 50 yards, even though I didn't win anything.
Well, it sounds exciting to me, and if I had been announcing that race, I think I would have been going crazy watching you sprint past him.
And by the way, Jesse Owens and Mac Robinson, they were my roommates in the village. Great guys, both of them, and Jesse Owens especially, he was a prince.
With the story of Jesse Owens and that Olympics and the snub by Adolf Hitler, was that something that you were aware of that had an impact
on
you at
Jesse
the time?
Well, Jesse Owens was, as I say, people loved Jesse Owens, even though they never met him, because nothing got him down. If people made a racial remark, he'd just say, hey, it's not my problem, it's their problem. And so as they came in, when Hitler came in the stadium, they were, by orders, had to stand up and cheer him. But when Jesse Owens came in, he got twice the ovation that Hitler got. And because of that, I think Hitler hated blacks, and especially Jesse Owens.
Well, I certainly understand that. I guess you ran that last lap at about Jesse Owens' sprint speed, too.
Yeah, I wish.
This is before, obviously, no one at that point, certainly from the West, had any idea of how evil Hitler really was and the things that he had planned, the things that he would carry out. What was your sense at the time of meeting this dictator?
Well, I think because the entire nation was military, we knew something was going on, and we figured he'd probably take over some country in Europe, and his plans were to take over the world. And I think we waited too long. Nobody wants to get involved, you know, the money and a war. Until it's too late, then you have to get involved, and then you got a real problem. Same thing happened with Japan. They were building an empire across the Pacific. Everybody knew, every school kid was taught in history class that they're moving fast all over east. And they've already come as far as the Marshall and Gilbert Islands. What's the next island? The next island would be Hawaii. And about 7 months before Hawaii was hit, they put out a bombing notice in four languages, which we brought back copies of that, warning people what to do in case of a bombing attack. Well, who else could bomb Hawaii but Japan?
Makes
Nobody
sense
else.
To me.
So it's kind of a ridiculous thing, and people got suspicious that the people in high office knew something, and they didn't let the public know.
We're talking to Louis Zamperini, and he lives in Southern California. Back in 1936, he was in Berlin for the Olympics with the American Olympic team, finished eighth in the 5,000 meters. And then, of course, you don't go home immediately after the race. And there are a lot of elements of your story, Louis, that are really incredible and hard to believe. But this one's right up there with them. You got a very unique souvenir after you were done running in Berlin. Tell me about that.
Well, you know, they had what they call beer automats, and the smallest beer they served in Germany was about a liter. <You know? laughs> So we put down a couple of beers, and walking down the street, and I was standing in front of the chancellery, and I thought, what a beautiful building with these groins and pillars. And then I noticed all the beautiful flags flying from the top of the building. Those were long satin-like flags. You could never get near them. Then I saw a smaller flag down on the front wall, and I saw the guards walking back and forth. I timed them, and I had plenty of time to get across the street, get that flag, and get away. But when I got there, the flag was higher than I had anticipated. And then the guards did reach the corner. When they turned around and saw me, they began to scream in German, and I knew they were mad. But I jumped up, clutched the flag in my hand, and ripped it from the pole. And then I did what I do best, and that's run. And then I heard a crack like a rifle shot, and the word halt was saying, well, I didn't need an interpreter for that. And so I halted, and they came up, and they spun me around rather rudely until they saw the American and Olympic flag on my coat pocket. And then they start talking to each other, and then the one officer who spoke very poor English, but I could understand him. He said, "But why did you tear down the swastika, you know?" And I said, "Well, I just wanted to take it home to America with me to always remind me of the wonderful time I had in your country." Well, he couldn't refuse, so he went inside, talked to von Fritz, because I remember when he came out, I remember the word Fritz.
Mm-hmm.
And he was told to let me have the flag, so I still have it.
You still have that flag?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's been, people come in and photograph it all the time, and it's been on a lot of TV shows.
Yeah, you've been a very popular guy lately, and I'm thrilled about that. 75 years you've had that flag now. That's hard to believe. And you made it back to the States, of course, after that. And I know that you enlisted in, you were a cadet in the Army Air Corps initially, then you were drafted into the Army. But what happened after that? How did you end up back in the Army Air Corps?
Well, first of all, I trained not for Berlin. I was aiming for the 1940 Tokyo Olympics. Well, of course, we were all in great shape. All the Olympians were looking forward to that Olympics in Japan. And then it was canceled because Japan was at war all over the East, and then Norway was supposed to pick it up, but then the war in Europe, they couldn't do that. So it was a heartbreaker. It was pretty hard to take when you train 4 years for one event. But then when Pearl Harbor was hit, it was a different story. Everybody forgot, and the athletes forgot about being athletes. They wanted to get in to get it over with as soon as possible. And so most guys that I know of just volunteered. We didn't wait for a draft. And I ended up in the Air Corps.
And you would end up on a B-24 crew?
Yeah, we were up in Oneida, Washington, Winnetka, Washington, waiting for our planes to come in, and we were hoping for B-17s because the B-24 was known at that time as the Flying Coffin. So, then in comes all these B-24s, and our hearts just sunk. And, of course, if you read the book, Unbroken, you'll realize how many B-24s, more were lost in training than combat.
Right. And the B-24, another nickname it has, the Flying Anvil. I don't know what's more intimidating, the Flying Anvil or the Flying Coffin.
Well, the plane did the job. It carried twice the bomb load of the B-17, and it was about 30 miles an hour faster. And so in the Pacific, they brought back all the B-17s because they couldn't fly to these far-off islands. And so we all had B-24s. Now, we took 26 of these B-24s and flew from Midway to Wake Island, bombed it, and flew back. And no plane in the world could do that at that time but a B-24. And then our missions were like, we'd have to fly like 1 or 2 days to our mission. In Europe, they'd get to the target in an hour or two.
That first mission that you had, or I guess not the first mission, you talked about bombing Wake Island. But I understand there was a mission not too long later where your B-24 got shot up pretty good.
Yeah, this was the Nauru raid. Now, this was the greatest concentration of nitrate in the world, bird droppings over millions of years. And the Japanese needed that for fertilizer and making bombs. And so they had it well fortified. We sent 26 bombers over, and we were in the lead group. And our job is to knock out the ACAC and stuff like that.
Right.
But by going over first, we got the worst of it. And my final bomb hit their supply depot, which smoke shot in the air about 8,000 feet. And all their fuel was burned up. And because of that, I think out of 9 Zeros that took off, 3 of them attacked us and wouldn't let us go. And I think the reason they were so persistently after us is because they knew that our bombs blew up their fuel supply. And so we had a running battle for several minutes, and the Japanese Zeros came in so close they couldn't miss us. And also, they were in so close we couldn't miss them. So we finally shot down all 3 Zeros, but not before taking on 5 cannon holes in the plane.
Oof.
Right tail shot off. A hydraulic tank was blasted, so we had no power for the flaps and everything else. We had to use a crank and crank them down. And we had 7 guys laid out. 1 died. But the 4 officers, the navigator, pilot, co-pilot, myself, we were untouched. But I pulled 1 guy off of the catwalk. Now, the bomb bay doors wouldn't close because the hydraulic tank was blowing up.
Right.
And so I walked back there, and I found the radio man on the catwalk, which is about 14 inches wide, and he was just laying there with one leg hanging out 8,000 feet above the ocean.
Ooh.
And he just looked up at me, and I pulled him back up on the flight deck, and I'm underneath the upper turret now. And the upper turret, his foot was level with my head. I gave Brooks a shot of morphine, and then he was trying to say something. I couldn't understand, and I bent over. Just as I bent over to listen to him, I heard a loud crack, and a 20-millimeter went through the radio compartment and shattered the upper turret gunner's leg and foot.
Oh.
But if I hadn't bent over, it would have hit me right in the head.
Wow.
So that was really, when I think about it, I just bent over to listen to him, and the blast went right where my head was and hit Pillsbury in the foot and his leg.
Talk about a close call. Holy moly.
My service in Pacific was one close call after another.
It sure sounds like it. And what amazes me about that mission, you came down in that B-24, and you're the bombardier, and you're explaining what you did to try to help your crewmate there. You guys actually landed that plane with 600 bullet holes in it?
Well, what happened, they had a submarine, I believe it was called the Drum, 20 miles on course towards our island. But with a running battle with those three Zeros, we passed that point. We're supposed to land on the water, and the submarine will pick us up. But we're way past that point, and now the four motors are humming pretty good, so but the rest of the plane was a mess. But we had it, so we decided to take a chance and get it back to Funafuti. The plane was so badly shot up, the pilot and co-pilot had both their hands and their knees on the yoke or the steering wheel to keep the plane from stalling because of all the damage. And we had 600 fragmentation of bullet holes in the plane, plus 5 cannon holes. And we got back, and the plane kept porpoising. So we had to come in low and hot. And this is a short runway, and you go right off the end of the runway, and we had no brakes. And so I had two parachutes tied to the waist, one in each window, and when we landed, I was going to deploy those chutes and stop the plane. And that's the first time it was ever supposed to be tried. But later, somebody else did it, and it does work. And then they used that for space shuttle and all that stuff. But anyway, we got back, and we came in low and hot. And when we hit the runway, I thought, man, we're going to go off the end. But just as we touched down, the plane ground looped to the left. Well, what happened, one of those 20-millimeter shells had gone through the front of the airplane into the wing between the number one and number two motor and actually penetrated the tire. So thank God the tire was flat because it caused us to ground loop. And now we're ground loop off of the runway with four motors going, and there's a bomber coming towards us with four motors going. This is really weird. And then the co-pilot knew we had no brakes, but he inadvertently pushed the brakes, and there was enough fluid in the brake well to cause it to lock momentarily, and that caused us to ground loop to the right. And so if he hadn't done that, we'd have gone straight into the other bomber, and both planes would have blown up.
Sure sounds like somebody was looking out for you that day.
That's what somebody said. You know, somebody up there loves you. I said, well, I'm glad somebody does.
Well, you can throw quite a few million people in that camp, a number that grows every time somebody reads Unbroken or Louis Zamperini's autobiography, The Devil at My Heels. That miraculous mission over Nauru was 80 years ago this week. It came so close to ending his life at so many points of that wild ride in a B-24, but it was nowhere near the worst of what he endured in World War II. We'll explore more of Louis Zamperini's incredible story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend. It's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode honoring the late, great Louis Zamperini. Motivated by some publicity this week around the 80th anniversary of his surviving a B-24 mission to Nauru, in which his B-24, Superman, received over 600 bullet holes and 5 cannon holes, one big enough for Louis to stick his face through in a famous photo from the time that has made the rounds this week 8 decades later. But it would be a month after that close call that the former Olympian would face his biggest nightmare on a mission that would forever change the course of his life.
It was a weird situation. When you go on a search mission, that's an all-day flight looking for enemy ships and enemy submarines. And when you get back, you get 2 days off. And we got back, and we were heading for the main gate when the operations officer drove out in a Jeep and told us to halt it. And they said a B-25 is reported going down 200 miles north of the island of Palmyra. And we want you to go look for him. Well, we knew our plane was being serviced. And he said, well, there's the Green Hornet. Well, nobody wanted to fly the Green Hornet. It couldn't get off of the ground with a bomb load. And when it did get off the ground, it was a musher. Tail was down, the nose was up. And he said, well, it passed inspection, and so that's like an order. So we decided to go down and look for the B-25. And so another plane flew ahead of us from another field in Hawaii, and we got down just where the plane reported last, and we began to circle. Now, the cloud cover was broken cloud at 1,000 feet. Now, we fly a search mission at 1,000 feet so you can see something. However, because of the broken cloud, we couldn't really see the ocean, so we flew under. That put us down to 800 feet. And we're scanning the ocean, and suddenly the number one motor goes out. Well, that plane could hardly fly on 4, so we're having a struggle. And just as they were trying to keep the plane straight and level and keep the altitude, the number two motor goes out. Well, with two motors on this plane, the Green Hornet just nosed over to the left wing down and just plowed right into the ocean and blew up. Pieces all over the place, oxygen tanks, gas tank, and what have you, and then, of course, the plane sank. But there were two life rafts that ejected from the plane automatically, and I was trapped in the waist section. My job is to hold a deflated raft in my arms in front of me. And as soon as we crashed, I ducked down low behind the tripod of the machine gun mount, and I ended up under the mount with the raft under my belly and my back up against the tripod. So I'm in there so solid, I doubt if two men could have got me out. And then the tail snapped off. When the tail snapped off, all the control wires go within an inch and a half of the tripod. And those are springy wires. They just curl up. They curled up all around me to make my situation even tougher. And I knew this was it. I knew that it started to sink. And I felt my ears pop, so I knew I was down 20 feet. And then I kept sinking down into the darkness. And then I felt a terrible pain in my forehead. I don't know what that was, but it felt like someone hit me with a sledgehammer. And then I lost consciousness. Now, before I lost consciousness, I just said to myself, God help me. And then I lost consciousness. And then while I'm still sinking to greater depths, even greater pressure, I'm conscious again. And just momentarily, I felt a kind of a euphoria that, hey, this is the afterlife. Because I knew there was no way I could get out. Then I realized I was still in the plane, and I was fighting for air, so I started to flail around with my arms. I'm in the waist section of the ship, pitch dark, and my USC ring on my index finger snagged onto the waste window. And that's what I was looking for. And then I realized what it was. I pulled myself out, inflated my life jacket, swallowing everything. I swallowed gas, oil, and blood all the way to the surface, threw it all up. And then I came up and looked. I heard, help, help. So the pilot and tail gunner were over hanging onto a gas tank, and they saw me. And they called it, help, help. So the life raft is drifting away in the current, so I'm trying to catch the raft. But I'm fully clothed with shoes on, and I couldn't catch the raft. And I thought, this is it. We're dead. And then as I turned back to look at the pilot and the tail gunner, there's a 100-foot cord attached to the trigger on the CO2 cartridge on the raft. And it's also embedded in the fuselage of the ship. And that's what inflates that raft. Well, as I looked over towards the other two guys, the last 3 feet of that cord was going by my face. Somewhat submerged. I couldn't really see it until it got close to me. And I grabbed that and reeled the raft back in, and that saved our lives, that raft. And then I rode to my buddies, and the pilot's head had tube gases. Blood was spurting, arterial blood. And so I had to, first of all, get a compress made out of my T-shirt. And I took another T-shirt and tied that down tight. And the funny thing is, I heard a gurgling sound. I looked around, I couldn't see anything, and then never heard another sound. So somebody had come to the surface, badly wounded, and just trying to say help, I guess. But it sounded gurgling, and then we couldn't find anything. So whoever it was, it just came to the surface momentarily and then sank. And so there's three of us now in the raft. The tail gunner, within 30 minutes, he starts screaming, we're going to die, we're all going to die. And that was pathetic. And I turned to him and said, look, nobody's going to die. We'll be rescued this afternoon or tomorrow or the next day. It settled down, Mac, and he wouldn't settle down. He kept screaming. So I tried to use psychology on him. I'd taken a course in psychology at USC, Psychology 51. It didn't work. So I threatened him. I said, when we're picked up, I'm making a report to the commander, and you'll be in real trouble. He kept on screaming. So I turned my back on him, and I came around with a backhand of my knuckles. I cracked him across the face. I knocked him on his butt, and he just lay there in complete contentment. He had a half smile on his face. A week later, or 5 days later, I had to do the same thing again. And after that, no problem. In fact, he got better and better as we went along instead of worse and worse. I thought if anybody hallucinates, it'll be him. But we buried him on the 33rd day, and he was sharper than he's ever been in his life. We had a program of mental exercises every day during the whole trip of 47 days. And our minds kept improving more and more. In fact, we were sharper after 47 days than we were the day we crashed.
Well, and this is unbelievable, and I know you lived it, and you've told the story so many times, and you just described it. But I'm imagining myself as someone who doesn't know your story and hearing this, and I want to highlight here some of the things. There were 11 men on your crew. Three of you survived initially, and you just said 47 days. You had to survive for 47 days lost at sea. How did you do that?
Well, the will to live. Now, I have a lot of young people say, well, did you ever think about dying out there? I said, not once. We never talked about dying. We only talked about living. And that fortified our constitution, you see. And then we had every day without telling them, I would come up with mental exercises like memorizing songs. Okay, I would teach them the hit top 40 songs. Dad was a minister. He'd teach us the words to the songs in the hymnal book. Mm-hmm. And every day we'd have some exercise, thinking back as far as you can think. And what are you going to do after the war? Every day we had something to keep our minds occupied, because my professor at SC, Dr. Webster, told us in class that the brain is like a muscle. Unless you exercise it every day, it will atrophy.
Now, so you told your crewmates the day that you crashed that, yeah, we'll be rescued tomorrow or later today. You survived 47 days hoping to be rescued by friendly forces. It's the Japanese who end up finding you. They're interrogating you. You've gone from 165 pounds to 65. Yet it seems like the way you describe it now, you woke up every day energized to make it to the next day.
Right. We had a strong will to live. There was no problem out there. We never thought about death or even talked about it. On the 27th day, that was our worst day on the 27th. That's when a plane flew over. It looked like a B-25 American plane. We shot flares to what would die in the ocean. The plane came down real low. We took our shirts off. We were waving and waving at them, and we knew we'd be rescued. And then we heard machine gun firing, and the bullets went right between our legs, and one hit the metal pump on one raft, and it tore the whole bottom of the raft out. So we only had one raft, three of us in that raft. Actually, 48 holes in that little raft, and none of us are touched by a bullet. You talk about another miracle, that was it.
Amen.
That went on for 30 minutes of strafing, and then they finally opened up their bomb bay doors and dropped the depth charge. That depth charge missed us about 50 feet, which would have killed us, but it failed to explode. So the bombardier improperly armed the bomb, and so fortunately we lived through that. And then it was a miserable time trying to patch that raft to keep it afloat because it was wrinkled, laying flat in the water, two sharks around us. And we had to keep pumping and pumping, and bubbles kept coming out. And then we just put as many patches on the top as we could. And then we got it in pretty good shape. And then we had to patch the bottom. Now, that's a trick. The raft is in two pieces. There's two tubes. So we let the air out of one half, pulled it up, let it dry, and tried to put a patch on it while we're sitting on the other half. In the meantime, there's always two sharks, always two of them. I don't know why they don't come in threes. And they were coming up trying to get us from the rear. So the tail gunner's job was to have an oar, and he would jab them on the nose. There's something about a shark's nose that they don't like. As a matter of fact, they found out last year a great white, when they stuck his nose out of the water, they touched it with their hands, and he became docile. The trick is to get them on the nose. And so that's what I did underwater. I straight armed the sharks, two of them, while the strafing was going on. And when I'd hit them on the nose, they'd take off. But they'd come back because they're still hungry. So the raft, we got in pretty good shape. We only had to pump up once every hour. And then of course, Mac died on the 33rd day. I was surprised he lived that long.
I know that your time's limited, Louie, and I don't want to accelerate you too far here, but you end up as a prisoner of war of the Japanese. And this is incredible to me as well. One of the gentlemen who ended up interrogating you was one of your USC classmates?
Yeah. Well, this guy on the panel, he said, when you were entering USC in 36, I was graduating. He was on the interrogation panel. But then an officer from another division on Kwajalein, he followed American sports and USC football and the Olympics. And so he came to the panel and said, instead of executing, our day of execution was already set. And anyway, he said it would better serve Japan's purpose to send him on to Japan to make propaganda broadcasts. Well, it made sense. I said, hey, great idea. So we got to go to Japan. And then, sure enough, they asked me to make a broadcast to my parents, which I wrote. And then they said, oh, you have beautiful radio voice. We want you to make another broadcast. At this time, they wrote the script, and it was propaganda, and I refused. And I think that's what Laura meant by being unbroken. On the raft and unbroken here because they had me severely punished on a daily basis because I wouldn't make the broadcast, and then they finally sent me to a slave labor camp, and I still wouldn't give in. And the war ended there at Camp 4B in Nowetsu, about 35 miles from Nagano, where the Olympics were held.
Yeah, and there's a story there, too. And now, you talk about that first broadcast that you got to make for your parents' benefit. Now, at that time, they believed that you had died, right?
Yeah, but the broadcast was so scrambly, the government wouldn't accept it as me. My parents were pretty sure it was me because I mentioned a few items that only they knew. But it was so incoherent that the Army said, no, there's no proof that he's alive, and so they kept me dead.
Wow. This is Louis Zamperini. He mentioned Unbroken. That, of course, the title of the best-selling book by Laura Hillenbrand, who also wrote Seabiscuit and another fast finisher in Louis Zamperini, her newest topic. His book is Devil at My Heels, or that other title, the alternate title, Death is My Companion. Louis Zamperini, full of life, and obviously you had to be to survive everything you did. You're captured in July of 43. Of course, the war doesn't end till 1945. More than 2 years in captivity. What was the hardest thing to endure that the Japanese did to you? What was the toughest thing for you to overcome?
Well, everything. On a daily basis, I'm beaten, and so I have to keep as far away from Watanabe, the bird we called him. And so I'm in a barracks with about 70 other men. So I always stayed in the back of the barracks so they come in for inspection. Two guards come in first and holler chest K until you come to attention. And then the bird does whatever he does. So he comes in. I'm way in the back. He came in and he looked around for about 5 or 7 seconds. He kept looking around for me and he saw me. And he hollered, "You come to attention last." Well, he looked around for a long time before he said that. And I didn't come to attention last, but he wanted to work me over. So he called me up. He had a big web belt about a 3/8 inch thick and 4 inches wide and a 1-pound steel buckle on there, a big, big buckle. He took his belt off and hit me across the forehead, knocked me to the ground. Now, I don't go down easily, but I'm laying there bleeding. And then he took out a piece of toilet paper and he handed it to me and he said, "Oh, like, I'm sorry." And I thought, well, he can't be that bad. So I wiped the blood. I stood up. I took the tissue and I pulled it away from my head to look to see how much blood was on it. And he hit me again in the same spot.
Oh.
This time I stayed down. And but I got that, you know, that was almost on a daily basis, the beatings from him. And I guess they gave word somehow that because I refused to make the broadcast on Tokyo Rose's program, that I was to be punished repeatedly. So I took a beating there, and then I thought, well, if I go to a slave labor camp, I'll get away from him. But they transferred him a week earlier. Now they have 100 camps in Tokyo proper. And they sent him to the very camp that I came to, so I had to put up with him again.
Holy moly.
And again, he threatened my life over and over again. And he said, if I draw my sword, I must use it. That's samurai law, you know. And then he had me take care of a sick goat. The goat was dying. He says, the goat dies, you die. Well, I knew the goat was going to die, and he did too. When the goat died, he took me outside and called everybody out, all the prisoners, hundreds. And I'm standing out there alone. And then he walks back and forth with his hand on his sword. The goat die, you die. And then finally he got two guys to bring over a big 4x6 cherry wood log, which is heavy, about 6-8 feet long. And he made me hold it over my head. Well, I held it for 10 minutes that I can remember, and then I went numb. And Henley Wade from England, he had a watch, and he timed it 37 minutes. I couldn't believe I held it that long, but I wasn't conscious of holding it after the first 10 minutes.
For anyone who has seen the film Unbroken, which came out right after Louis Zamperini's passing in 2014, that scene may be the most memorable. We're going to hear more of Louis's memories when we come back, and also a few words from the author who wrote about him in Unbroken, Laura Hillenbrand. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode reflecting on the incredible life of Louis Zamperini. His death-defying mission over Nauru was 80 years ago this weekend. His death-defying mission over Nauru was 80 years ago this week, but it was everything that followed that would come to define this prisoner of war's inspirational story. Before we hear more of Louis's memories, a few thoughts from Laura Hillenbrand, author of the bestseller about his life, Unbroken.
I had to write a book about him. We had our first conversation. He told me his whole story. We talked for quite a long time, and I was just astonished by it and so compelled by all the questions that raised in my mind about how a person can forgive the unforgivable and recover from suffering as deep as he went through. I had no thoughts about what the audience might be for this, but I did think people would be interested in it. No, I didn't. I don't think anybody expects the reach the story has had. But then again, why shouldn't I have expected it? He has maybe the most extraordinary life I've ever heard of.
It really is. And what's amazing is he'd been telling his story to small groups, large groups for a long time, but yet most of the world didn't know about it until you put it in print.
A lot of history goes to the grave with people. A lot of history just goes untold, and it's a wonderful privilege to be able to talk to these people who have lived superlative lives as Louis did, and to be able to write it down, to try to research and learn more about their own lives than they knew themselves, you know, about things that were happening because of them or around their story, and to try to tell the whole thing in context. It's a great privilege, and it's a great pleasure.
I'm sure you've been asked this a lot, and it's hard to come up with one thing, but when people ask you about Louis, about your interactions with him or your experience in capturing his story, if there's one single greatest significant aspect of who he was and what the rest of us can learn from his experience and the way he handled it, what do you think that would be?
I think what Louis and the life he lives has taught us is that our potential to be resilient, to endure, and to overcome is far greater than we give ourselves credit for. We are not going to be going through the same experiences he went through, but most of us are going to face things in our lives that are bigger than we are, or so we think. And what Louis has to say about that is, it's not bigger than you. Nothing's bigger than you. You can overcome this. You can apply your resilience. You have it in you. And I hear it all the time, and he did too, that, you know, if you got through what you got through, I can get through this cancer. I can get through this loss, or I can get through this thing I fear. And I think that's what he wanted people to know. It was very, very important to him to use his suffering for good. And that's what he did. He taught us this lesson. I carry it with me every day of my life.
Well, and that was my follow-up, and I don't want to cross any lines or get too personal if you don't want to, but as you say that, I'm thinking, boy, it sure sounds like Laura has applied this in her own life, that there's things that you've had to take that, you know, fighting spirit that Louis exemplified and apply it to your own circumstances.
Well, one of the things Louis knew that a lot of people didn't know about me is that I've had a pretty terrible chronic illness for 30 years, something called myalgic encephalomyelitis, and it was a devastating illness that for a number of years left me completely bedridden. And for much of the time that I worked on the book, I actually was bedridden. And Louis knew this, and because he knew it, he felt that I could understand something about suffering and about confinement and being separated from your body's capacity to do what it does naturally, you know, to be an athlete or to just be out in the world. He knew I got that, even though I hadn't been through the same kind of experience he had been through. And it enabled him, he said, to really open up to me in a way that he hadn't with anybody else, to really, really tell me the story, because veterans very often fear opening up about what they went through because they're afraid people will not understand and it will be trivialized to them. It will look like it did in bad old war movies that don't really capture what what these things are. And it was an interesting place where Louis and I met, this place of suffering and deprivation. And I was able to take his strength sometimes when I was feeling really badly. I could talk to him and I could be renewed. I could keep going when it was very, very hard. There was a span while I was writing this book, for 2 years I was unable to leave my house because I was simply too weak to walk to my car. And Louis helped carry me through that time just with his buoyance, his effervescence, his belief in me. And that was a beautiful thing. He actually, after he learned about my illness, which I did not tell him about for quite a while, he read an article on me, and that's how he learned it. He mailed me his Purple Heart, which I was just blown away that he did that. And I said, I cannot accept this. And he said, you deserve this more than I do. And he insisted that I keep it. I still don't think I deserve it. I mean, he deserved it. But this was this thing that we shared, this connection we shared, and it enabled us to be very close and work well together for 7 years.
Laura Hillenbrand, author of Unbroken, which allowed Louis's incredible story to reach so many millions more around the world. Let's conclude the show with more from that 2011 interview with Louis here on Hometown Heroes.
Your story is so unbelievable, Louis. From you could have been shot to death in the plane, you could have drowned, you could have starved to death, you almost did, now you're almost beaten to death in captivity. So when you got to that moment where you were finally liberated, how wonderful a day was that for you?
Well, that was it was a beautiful day. We were suspicious. You see, there's always rumors the war's over, so we didn't believe anything. But this one guard came to me and he said, a horrible thing happened in a city called Hiroshima. A cholera broke out, and nobody can communicate with Hiroshima. And I thought, cholera, my God, how horrible. I'm glad we're hundreds of miles north. But that was the first atomic bomb, and the Japanese lied to the public.
Mm-hmm.
But then when the second bomb was dropped, they told the truth immediately because they had no choice. So that ended the war, and then a plane flew over, and we wrote PW on the roof. They circled left, and then the bird disappeared. He knew the war was over before we did. He skipped out and hid out in the mountains for 10 or 12 years. In the meantime, a TBF flew over from a carrier and sent us the Morse code in red light, that the war was over. And we were in the river for the first time swimming. We always wanted to go in that fresh water to clean ourselves. They wouldn't let us do it.
Mm.
But then the day they let us do it, I thought, well, maybe the war is over. And so anyway, we came out of there, and the TBF dropped a long red streamer. And we picked it up, and on the end was a candy bar with a bite out of it and a pack of cigarettes with one cigarette missing. We had to divide both of those up with several hundred men.
Mm.
We had to form circles. One cigarette. Everybody takes one puff, and so it goes around the circle. It was really funny, but we were serious. And then the chocolate, we got a little teeny sliver just to taste it, and that was it. Now, Commander Fitzgerald of the Perch submarine, he was in command, a highest-ranking officer with us, and he made sure that everybody got one puff of a cigarette and a little taste of the chocolate. And then, of course, the B-29s came over and dropped tons of food on us, and instead of hating the guards, they were complaining about their families starving at home. So we gave them a lot of food from the bombers.
Well, your stomachs probably couldn't take that much anyway.
Well, the thing is, the commander warned the guys, you know, you haven't been eating good food. You've been eating seaweed and barley for years, and so take it easy on the food. Well, some guys were so hungry, they just, pea soup was supposed to be diluted with a can of water. And they would eat it straight, so some guys got diarrhea from that, but the smart guys just ate a little more every day until they got used to it.
And isn't it incredible that after all that, these emaciated Americans were willing to share that food with their Japanese guards? I cut Louis off there. I didn't let him finish the story about the bird and that beam that he had to hold above his head for 37 minutes. Well, after 37 minutes, the bird punched him in the stomach, the beam fell on Louis's head, and knocked him unconscious. Not that you didn't think it was bad before, but now I think you have an even clearer picture of how brutally Louis was treated.
Now, your story is just so incredible, Louis. Very few people in the history of the world have endured everything that you have. And I know we're running short on time here. You talked about the liberation. You come home. Obviously, you're in no shape to be an Olympian again for 48 in London.
Right.
But eventually you realized maybe that there was a purpose, that everything that had happened to you could be turned into good in your life. And I understand that Billy Graham had a role in that.
Yeah, eventually, Billy, when I got, I took my time coming home, by the way. I got fattened up, and I was back to a normal weight by the time I got to San Francisco. And it was really, and that's another story, the repatriation. You could do another book on that.
I believe and, it. Maybe you should.
Anyway, I went to hell and almost got killed on the way home. You know, there was a bomber. We were supposed to fly to Manila, but socked in. I'm leaving Okinawa now, gradually working my way home. We were told to land at Loag, a small city in northern Luzon, on a fighter strip, stayed there all night. Next day, they gave us clearance to go to Manila, and we took off with this bomber full of about 40 prisoners inside, and the runway's too short. There was a berm on the end of the runway that they put there to keep the ocean from flooding the runway. And I was up there between the pilot and co-pilot, and I knew we weren't going to make it, and they did too. We hit the berm, bounced in the air, and settled so low that the Whitecaps came through the bomb bay doors and got all the prisoners wet. And I thought, this is it. After all I've been through, I'm dead. And then the plane gradually pulled up. We got to Manila. Now, a couple of years ago, I got a call from a fellow in the East, and he asked me how I got to Manila. When I told him about that bomber taking off, he said, well, I was the pilot, and I almost went in my pants. So, yeah, anyway, that's really funny. Yeah, so anyway, I got home, and of course, big celebrations, and I had a ball, and then I finally got married. But I had a terrible nightmare. I had these nightmares in prison about the bird. I was always strangling the guy, and I had that nightmare all the way home. I never missed a night. And before I got married, I had the nightmare every night. After I got married, I still had the nightmares. Mm. I'm always strangling the bird. And I grabbed my wife by the throat one night, and boy, I got scared. I woke up in a cold sweat, and then I started to drink heavily and became a boozer. And then she decided it was time for a divorce. But then somebody talked her into going down to hear a new young evangelist, Billy Graham. And she came home speaking of this peace and joy she had in her heart and life, and I wouldn't go with her. I got mad, but then she said something that made me happy. She said, because of my conversion, I'm not going to get a divorce. Well, that softened me up a little bit, so I did go down to hear Billy, but I walked out the first night mad. I said, I'll never go back to that place again. But the next day, after 2 hours of argument, she got me back. As I started to leave, he was in his preaching, he said, when people come to the end of their rope, and there's nowhere else to turn, they turn to God, no matter who you are. I thought, yeah, that's what happened to me on the raft in prison camp on Kwajalein. And that made me feel like a fool. I prayed the same prayer over and over again, God, get me home alive, and I'll seek you and serve you. Here I am alive, and I didn't try to seek God. So then I went forward in the meeting and made a confession of my faith in Christ, and boy, I knew something happened. I was still on my knees, but I knew I was through getting drunk. I knew I'd forgiven all my guards, and including the bird. That was something. And I was a different person. Right there on my knees, I got up, went home, and that's my life has been changed ever since.
And you eventually became a missionary in Japan, the same country that had tortured you. You talked about the bird, and you forgave him. I guess you did. If you would go back there to Japan to try to share this new love in your life with them.
I went back to Japan. Sagamo Prison, that's where all the prisoners were, 850 of them, and nobody was allowed in there. But I called MacArthur's headquarters, SAC, and reminded him that he asked for 10 million Bibles and 2,000 missionaries when he took over the country, but we didn't respond. And that's so he let me into Sagamo Prison, so I was the first outsider allowed in there to speak, and 850 war criminals, and the colonel asked me to give them a chance to become Christian, so I did. And then he asked those who knew me to come forward, so about 8 guards came forward, and sure enough, there was James Sasaki, head interrogator in Japan proper, and he's the one that went to SC with me in 37, 38, 39. So I said, well, where's the bird? And he said, well, we believe he committed harakiri. So I assumed he was dead all these years. And then when CBS did my show out of Nagano during the Olympics, Donna Mihailovich was in Tokyo. And he called me and he said, are you sitting down? Yeah. You got a hold of your chair? I said, I got a hold of my chair. What's up? He says, we found the bird. He's alive. Oh, I couldn't believe it. So anyway, they took a picture of a movie of him, and it was on 60 Minutes, and it's still being shown across the nation. The Olympic Committee sends them out to schools, and so everybody can see the entire story in about 35 minutes.
And that is online, and I'll make sure that we point a link to that.
They called it the Great Zamperini, which I didn't like, but he said, well, you know, there was the Great Mussolini, the Great Zucchini, and the Great Houdini. So I thought, well, in that case, I'll leave it.
You prefer Lucky Louie, huh?
Yeah, Lucky Louie's fine. A great. I don't think anybody's great.
That humility only made him more endearing. The late, great Louis Zamperini. Boy, it brought back a lot of good memories and some inspiring thoughts by revisiting his story this week. I hope you found it as valuable as I did. And I hope you can join us again next time on Hometown Heroes, when we'll be reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.